So think about this for a second. Like 91% of teenage mental health crises happen after the school counselor goes home for the day.
Right, when the building is empty.
Exactly. The office is dark, the doors are locked, the adults are asleep. So when a student texts a school support line at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday night, who answers?
Yeah, or I guess more accurately, in the current tech landscape, what answers?
Exactly. What answers? And that is exactly what we're getting into today. Welcome to this deep dive. Today is a really special one for you, the listener, because this is the Sunday 3 Champions edition of Conversational AI Watch, which is warmly sponsored by Clinician Assist.
And, when you look at how we usually talk about artificial intelligence, the conversation is just, it's completely dominated by hypotheticals,
Oh,
right?
absolutely.
Like we argue about what algorithms might do in 5 years, or we, panic over these massive sweeping regulations being debated in courts. It's just this constant deafening noise.
Yeah, and it almost completely ignores the practical reality of actually deploying this tech today. So today's mission is entirely different. We are stepping completely out of that echo chamber to focus on the unglamorous, highly technical mechanics of accountability.
The boring stuff that actually matters.
Right, the stuff that saves lives. We're unpacking this fascinating newsletter issue that profiles three leaders operating in totally different spheres. So we have a state policy director, a hospital CEO, and a startup founder.
Solving completely different problems.
Completely different. But they all independently arrived at the exact same really brutal realization about AI in high-stakes environments.
Yeah, they realize that the most advanced feature of artificial intelligence isn't actually the algorithm.
Wait, really? What is it, Ben?
It's the architecture of human accountability built around it. Like a human being's name actually has to go on the line for whatever the machine outputs.
Right. And I want you, the listener, to really think about how you use AI right now. Like if you use it to summarize a 50-page PDF or, I don't know, write a first draft of a marketing email, the stakes are practically zero.
Yeah, if it hallucinates, you just, delete the sentence and move on. No harm done.
Exactly. But you inject that exact same technology into clinical health care or adolescent mental health. The margin for error just vanishes. We aren't talking about bad copy anymore. We're talking about literal life and death.
It's a completely different ballgame.
So, okay, let's unpack this. Because I like to think about it less as an autonomous brain and more as like a high-powered autocomplete for empathy.
Autocomplete for empathy, I like that.
Right. Because it can generate the words, it can bridge the data and sort of formulate the sentiment. But a human still has to hold the steering wheel.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is that the overarching theme in the source material is that none of these three leaders took the standard Silicon Valley approach.
Oh, definitely not.
Because the default stance in tech is always, get out of our way, reduce friction, let us scale as fast as possible.
Move fast and break things.
Exactly. But these three deliberately introduced friction. They engineered the exact moment where the autocomplete function must abruptly stop, and a named legally liable human just has to take over.
So let's look at the legal blueprint first. Because if you really want to understand how to force a tech company to accept friction, you have to look at how governments are trying and, let's be honest, mostly failing to write the rules of the road.
Oh, yeah. State governments historically have a terrible track record with emerging tech. I mean, the instinct is almost always just a blanket ban.
Right, because they don't understand it.
Exactly. Legislators who don't understand the underlying code try to write these rigid statutes, which take years to pass, right? And by the time the ink is dry, the technology has already evolved like three generations past the law.
But Utah took a completely different approach,
Yeah.
which I found so interesting. They didn't put a career politician in charge of their AI policy. They handed the reins to Zach Boyd.
Yeah, the mathematician.
Right, he's an applied mathematician from Brigham Young University. And in April 2024, he became the director of Utah's brand new Office of Artificial Intelligence Policy, which was established by Senate Bill 149.
And putting a mathematician in charge completely changed the state's methodology.
How so?
Well, instead of trying to write a static law to govern dynamic software, the legislature gave Boyd's office sandbox authority.
Sandbox authority. That sounds like a playground for tech bros.
Right, it sounds like that, but it's not a playground at all. It's actually a highly structured, temporary legal shield. They use what are called regulatory mitigation agreements.
Okay, what does that actually mean in plain English?
They are literal binding contracts between the state of Utah and a private tech company.
Okay, so the state identified mental health AI as their primary area of concern, right?
Yeah.
And the first contract they executed under the sandbox was with a Utah-based company called ElizaChat.
Yeah, that was signed in November 2024 and announced on December 2nd.
Right, and ElizaChat is basically an app provided by schools to support teenage mental wellness. But the terms of this contract are incredibly invasive compared to, like, normal software terms of service.
Oh, absolutely. Utah demanded that ElizaChat implement strict internal safety protocols. Like, they had to pilot with trusted human testers before any wide release.
That makes sense.
And they were subjected to a 30-day correction period if the app strayed into providing unlicensed therapy.
Which is a huge risk with these chatbots.
Massive risk. And most critically, they had to legally commit to an escalation protocol, meaning the second the AI hit a predefined risk threshold, it had to seamlessly hand the user over to a licensed human therapist.
Okay, wait. I need to stop and look at the timeline here because this made zero sense from a traditional governance perspective.
How do you mean?
Usually, a legislature passes a law, right?
Yeah.
Then the regulatory agency publishes the rules, and then companies scramble to adjust their products to comply. But Utah signed a bespoke contract with one single startup before they even had a statewide mental health AI law on the books.
Right.
Regulating by individual exception seems incredibly inefficient. Like, why not just write the law first?
Well, because writing the law first is exactly how you end up with obsolete regulations.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, doing it backward was the core brilliance of Boyd's strategy. By putting ElizaChat into this sandbox, Utah created a real-world controlled laboratory.
So they didn't have to guess.
Exactly. Yeah. The regulators didn't have to guess how a mental health chatbot might fail. They got to watch it operate under the safety net of the contract.
That's fascinating.
They saw firsthand how the escalation triggers functioned, where the natural language processing struggled with teenage slang.
Because teenagers talk in riddles.
Constantly. And they saw what kind of oversight actually protected the user in the real world.
So they basically let the startup do all the stress testing, but they kept them on a very tight legal leash while they gathered the data.
Exactly. And that data directly authored the permanent legislation. The lessons from that single ElizaChat contract formed the foundation of Utah House Bill 452, which Governor Spencer Cox signed on March 25, 2025.
Making it the first state law in the country governing mental health chatbots.
Right. And the law is pragmatic because it was field tested. It mandates clear disclosure that the user is speaking to an AI. And it strictly prohibits the sale of personal health information or the use of user inputs for targeted advertising.
It also engineered this really fascinating shift in liability through a mechanism called an affirmative defense.
Yeah, this is where the legal mechanics get really smart.
Walk us through it.
So an affirmative defense is essentially a regulatory safe harbor. It protects the tech company from certain types of liability lawsuits, but, and this is key, it is entirely conditional.
Meaning you have to earn it.
Yes, you only get the shield if you fulfill specific proactive duties first. A company has to maintain and publish a written policy explicitly stating the chatbot's purpose, its capabilities, and its hard limitations.
So you basically don't get the legal defense unless you have already mapped out exactly where your machine stops. Which is a massive takeaway for you, the listener, whether you are building software or just buying it for your enterprise. Innovation doesn't have to mean moving fast and breaking things.
No, especially not here.
Right. When you're dealing with vulnerable populations, innovation looks like moving meticulously, establishing the contracts first, and securing a legally binding safety net before you scale.
Yeah, Utah really proved you can force safety architecture onto a public-facing wellness app. But, you know, a public app is a relatively low stakes compared to the environment our second leader was facing.
Oh, exactly.
When you step off the public roads and into the clinical reality of a hospital ward, the liability calculus changes completely.
It totally does. Which brings us to our second champion. Let's look at Dr. Christopher Longhurst. Now, he became the chief executive officer of Seattle Children's on January 5, 2026.
Right.
But the data we were examining actually comes from his previous tenure at UC San Diego Health, specifically looking back at the spring of 2023.
Yeah, and to set the scene, the clinical environment at that time was basically at a breaking point.
This was right after the pandemic.
Exactly. Coming out of the pandemic, patient portal messages, you know, the secure emails patients sent to their doctors had just exploded. The volume grew 3 to 4-fold.
Wow.
Physicians were drowning in their inboxes. They were spending hours every single night just trying to answer basic medical questions. So UC San Diego Health deployed artificial intelligence to read the patient messages and draft the replies.
Okay, so they plugged the autocomplete into the patient files, but Longhurst instituted this absolute non-negotiable rule regarding the workflow.
Which was so crucial.
Right. The AI architecture was physically severed from the send button.
Yes.
The machine was incapable of sending a message to a patient on its own. A human physician had to open the AI-generated draft, actively review the medical information, edit it if necessary, and permanently attach their own signature to it.
And he combined that physical friction with aggressive transparency.
How aggressive?
Well, the AI Governance Committee mandated that every single message processed this way had to include a highly visible disclaimer.
Yeah.
It literally read, "Part of this message was generated automatically and was reviewed and edited by..." And then the name of the physician.
Oh, wow. So they didn't try to hide it at all?
Not at all. They didn't try to pass the AI's work off as the doctor's original typing. They put the tool right out in the open.
That takes guts.
It does. And Longhurst felt so strongly about this that he co-authored a piece in NEJM AI in 2025, basically demanding this level of disclosure become the industry standard.
Because others weren't doing it.
Right. Specifically because hundreds of other institutions were quietly using these tools without telling their patients.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. And I want to dig into the actual results of this deployment. Because the source material presents this massive contradiction.
Time study, yeah.
Yes. Longhurst was the senior author on a study published in JAMA Network Open in April 2024 that evaluated this exact AI drafting program. And the data showed that using the AI did not make the doctors any faster.
Not even a little bit.
The total time spent managing their inboxes didn't decrease by a single minute. So my question is, if a piece of enterprise technology doesn't save time, it fails the most basic return on investment test imaginable.
On paper, sure.
Right. So why on earth would a hospital system spend the money and absorb the massive medical legal risk of hallucinations for a tool that doesn't actually speed anything up?
Well, to understand the ROI there, you really have to look past the stopwatch and look at the psychology of the physician.
Okay.
The actual metric of success here was the reduction of cognitive burden.
Cognitive burden. Break that down for me. How does it not save time, but it reduces the burden?
Okay, so picture a doctor at the end of a grueling 14-hour clinical shift. They sit down at a computer and open an inbox with, say, 70 unread messages from anxious patients.
I'm getting stressed just thinking about it.
Exactly. The mental energy required to stare at a completely blank screen, synthesize a patient's chart, formulate a medically accurate plan, and then translate all of that into a warm, empathetic tone. It is staggering.
Yeah, that is heavy cognitive lifting.
It is. Now, compare that to opening a message where an AI has already synthesized the chart and written an 80% complete draft in a really polite tone.
Okay.
The doctor still has to spend 3 minutes reading it, maybe adjusting a dosage amount and verifying the logic. The clock time is identical, but the cognitive activation energy required to edit is just a fraction of the energy required to create from scratch.
Right. It's the difference between staring at a completely blank canvas and having the outline already sketched out for you.
Yes, exactly.
Like, you still have to mix the paints and apply the color, but the paralyzing part, the blank page, is completely gone.
Yeah, but, you know, Longhurst was also highly aware of the specific legal risks of this workflow, primarily something called automation bias.
Automation bias, meaning what exactly?
Well, when a human is exhausted and the machine gives them a highly confident professional-sounding draft, the human instinct is just to hit approve without really reading it.
Oh, sure. You just trust the machine because it sounds smart.
Right. And that is why the physical signature and the patient disclosure were so critical. By forcing the doctor's name onto the disclaimer and telling the patient about the AI, Longhurst kept the physician psychologically engaged.
Because the doctor knows the patient is going to read that disclaimer and hold them personally accountable for every single word.
Precisely. They can't just glaze over it.
And Longhurst had this quote in the material about empathy that completely flips how we usually view tech. I found this fascinating. People were asking him about studies showing that patients often rated the AI chatbot replies as more empathetic than the ones written entirely by human doctors.
Yeah, which sounds crazy at first.
It does. We usually assume AI is cold and calculating. But Longhurst was incredibly blunt about it. He said, could a doctor be as empathetic as a chatbot? Undoubtedly, they just don't always have the time.
It is a profound realization, really. The machine isn't more compassionate. It just has infinite patience and zero fatigue.
Yeah, it doesn't need to sleep.
Right. It can spend paragraphs validating a patient's feelings, whereas a human doctor who's literally rushing to the next exam room can only afford a one-sentence reply.
So the AI supplies the raw volume of empathy, but the human supplies the clinical accountability,
Exactly.
which actually exposes a terrifying gap in this whole ecosystem, because Longhurst doctors are highly trained professionals operating in the daylight inside a fully resourced hospital system.
Yeah, a very controlled environment.
Right. But let's go back to that statistic from the very beginning of the deep dive. What happens when the user isn't an adult checking a patient portal on a Tuesday afternoon, but a teenager spiraling into a crisis at 11 o'clock at night?
And that brings us to our third leader, who is operating in the most volatile environment of all, the startup sector.
Yes, Drew Barbier.
Right. Drew Barbier is a 2023 graduate of Stanford's MBA program and the CEO of Sonar Mental Health. Their core product is called Sunny, and it's a text-based service deployed directly into middle and high schools.
And they were pretty well funded, right?
Yeah, they had raised a $2.4 million pre-seed round as of February 2025, and at that time they were serving over 4,500 students.
And their internal data showed that 91% of the conversations happening on Sunny take place outside of normal school hours, which is huge.
Huge. When the traditional safety net of teachers and counselors goes offline, the app just lights up.
So if you are building software for that specific reality, how do you handle accountability? Like, you can't just have a doctor review it the next morning. The crisis is happening right now.
You need an immediate response.
Right. So Sonar's solution was a severe human-in-the-loop architecture. The AI is literally not connected to the outgoing messaging system. It reads the incoming text from the teenager and suggests responses on an internal dashboard.
Yeah.
And then a trained human being, titled a well-being coach, physically types, edits, and sends every single message the student receives.
And it's important to note those coaches are constantly supervised by a licensed clinical team.
So there's layers of oversight.
Exactly. The clinical license sits above the coach, providing real-time oversight. And Barbier is exceptionally clear in his positioning here. Sunny is not a therapist, and it does not provide medical treatment. It is strictly a well-being and triage service.
Okay, I have to look at the unit economics of this because honestly, it sounds like a terrible business model.
It does sound expensive.
Right. The entire financial promise of artificial intelligence is automation. You eliminate human labor to achieve infinite scale at zero marginal cost.
That's the Silicon Valley dream.
Yeah. So if Sonar requires a human being to sit at a dashboard, manually read the AI suggestion, and physically hit send for every single text message, they haven't built an AI startup. They've just built a highly inefficient call center.
I mean, that's a fair critique.
So how does a company with that much human overhead survive, let alone scale, when their competitors are fully automated?
They survive because when the ultimate stress test happens, the fully automated competitors collapse.
What do you mean by the ultimate stress test?
Well, in 2026, the Common Sense Media Youth AI Safety Institute partnered with Stanford Medicine's Brainstorm Lab to execute a massive independent risk assessment of AI mental health applications.
Okay.
And they didn't rely on the startup's marketing claims. They conducted adversarial testing.
Adversarial testing. So they didn't just ask the app's basic questions, they actively tried to break the guardrails.
Exactly. Researchers created simulated teen personas and engaged these platforms in multi-turn conversations, deliberately driving the dialogue towards severe crisis triggers like self-harm or abuse.
Wow, so they were really pushing it.
Yeah, they wanted to see exactly how the autocomplete function behaved when the data indicated an immediate threat to life.
So they threw a simulated crisis at Sunny.
They did. And because Sonar had stubbornly refused to automate that final step because they had that strict human-in-the-loop architecture, the system worked flawlessly.
That's amazing.
Oh.
Yeah, the AI flagged the language, the human well-being coach recognized the severity, and a real physical person called the simulated student's emergency contact by phone within 15 minutes, all while the coach kept the student engaged over text.
Wait, 15 minutes from a text message to a physical phone call escalating the crisis.
Yes.
That's incredible.
And you have to compare that to the fully automated apps in the exact same tests.
How did they do?
The platforms that sold their chatbots straight to teenagers with zero humans in the loop and no connection to a school system landed in the absolute lowest, most dangerous category of the risk assessment.
Ouch.
They failed completely. Some gave generic hotline numbers and disconnected. Others hallucinated totally inappropriate advice.
That is terrifying.
It is. The architecture of supervision, literally forcing a human to be the one to hit send, was the literal, measurable difference between successfully managing a life-threatening crisis and abandoning a vulnerable kid in the dark.
So you asked how they scale. The independent count later showed sonar scaling to over 25,000 young people. And the source material also references another company utilizing the exact same human-in-the-loop architecture that reached over 100,000 students. And they also successfully got a trained human on the phone during the same simulated
So
crisis.
the model does scale.
It does,
Yeah.
but it scales safely, prioritizing resilience over cheap automation.
Yeah, and if we step back and synthesize the journey of these three leaders, a very clear roadmap emerges for the future of this technology.
Let's hear it.
We started with Zach Boyd, a mathematician regulating state policy, who recognized that you can't just ban AI, but you must legally mandate the escalation point to a human therapist.
Right.
Then we moved to Dr. Christopher Longhurst, a hospital CEO, who proved that AI's greatest value might actually be lifting the cognitive burden off burnt-out physicians, but only if the physician's name and reputation are visibly attached to the final output.
And finally, Drew Barvier, a startup founder who looked at the midnight reality of adolescent crises and built an entire company around the refusal to let a machine speak directly to a child.
Yeah, three distinct champions evaluating the exact same cutting-edge algorithms and arriving at the identical conclusion.
Is that the algorithm is secondary. The architecture of human accountability is the primary product.
Exactly. And as you, the listener, look at your own industry, whether you are deploying AI for customer service, data analysis, or, internal logistics, you have to ask yourself the hard questions these leaders asked.
Don't just marvel at what the language model is capable of generating.
No, you have to look at your workflows and ask, where exactly does the machine stop? What is the trigger for human escalation? And when the system inevitably fails, whose name is legally and professionally on the line?
I mean, we've spent the last decade trapped in a very specific, very loud narrative about artificial intelligence. The assumption across the business world is that the ultimate goal of AI is to relentlessly replace human jobs, cut overhead, and automate everything in the pursuit of margin.
Yeah, that's the story we've been told.
But if the ultimate non-negotiable safety net for artificial intelligence is human accountability,
Yeah.
if you literally cannot survive the adversarial testing of a real-world crisis without a human being physically picking up a telephone, it completely rewires our
It
expectations.
really does.
So here's something for you to mull over. Will the most valuable, most legally resilient, most trusted tech companies of the next decade actually be the ones that employ the most humans? The autocomplete is incredibly powerful, but it doesn't matter if no one is holding the steering wheel. Keep your name on your work.